Welcome to the More Perfect Union, a podcast about the joy we get from American politics, or as we like to call it, real debate without the hate. I'm DJ McGuire, your Republican in exile from Suffolk, Virginia.
I'm Rebecca Kushmider, your Liberal Democrat in Kensington, Maryland.
I'm Cliff Dunn, your Republican not in exile from Newport News, Virginia.
I'm Kevin Kelton, a moderate Democrat from Los Angeles, California.
I'm Molly Cooper, your free market conservative who votes Republican by default.
And I'm Greg Matuszak, your liberal Democrat from Cincinnati, Ohio. The More Perfect Union can be heard on iTunes, iHeartRadio, and at our website, moreperfectunionpodcast.com, where you can also find host bios and written commentary.
Once again this week, we found ourselves going long after the official podcast and having quite an interesting conversation after the show is over. So here once again is an MPU After Dark special edition.
You know, the one thing we didn't talk about, and I didn't think to put it in, there are whispers up in the New York press that Chris Christie is going to get a job in the Trump administration.
Yeah, doing what?
I don't know, maybe making sure the meatloaf is at the right temperature.
I know, yeah.
Did you guys hear the meatloaf story?
I have no clue.
Hey, at least they already have a Secretary of Transportation, so we cannot worry about traffic jams from him.
What job would he be up for, DJ?
Salute, Cliff. The job itself was unnamed. Yeah, he may end up as National Security Advisor.
Nobody
after
else
Trump.
Wants the what? Job.
Really? You know, they can always make him president of the fitness council.
No, come on now.
Oh, boo. We're Cole. Better than yeah, that.
I was going to say, you're better than that, Cliff.
You're right. It was a bad joke. I should make better jokes.
Maybe you know, for the Trump administration, they'll be like, you know, he'll be like the alternate. So, like, when the next one, like, you know, has to opt out or gets fired, like, he gets slotted
That's
in.
That's a great
you know?
Idea.
Oh, yeah. No, he could be like Swing in a Broadway show where, you know, whenever somebody is indicted on corruption charges, Christie fills in for a while till they get a permanent replacement.
It's more like big-time wrestling. They tag in.
The understudy. That's what it'll be. He'll be our national understudy. He'll fill in for the next resignation. That's
you
what
know,
it is.
I see him as wearing like a big lucha mask, like Mexican wrestling. And he runs down the halls and someone goes, quick, tag me in. Anytime there's an indictment. And then he stands there guarding their office.
I grew up in Jersey. I used to actually like this guy. You know, during his first term, he was a brutally honest governor. And then he comes up with an attempted pension fix in 2011. And then 3 years later says, okay, pensions are still messed up. And he takes no responsibility for the fact that he said he fixed it 3 years earlier and now is saying that he didn't. I mean, it's just – it was – I mean – I know I'm weird in that I'm an analyst and that I care about, but the fact that he essentially lied on the pension reform, that bothered me more than the whole Bridgegate thing. But that's just me.
Oh, I don't know. That would bother me.
I would say Bridget Kelly might disagree with you.
Hey, what are you guys hearing about? And I didn't want to put this in this week. There's no undersecretaries. None of them have been hired. And none of them have been working out. A lot of them have been fired. So all the secretaries of such and such, none of them have there's this big rumor going on that none of the offices actually work. And they don't
actually. Yeah, no, there are over 600 appointee-level positions that I don't even know if they've submitted names on a lot of them.
Probably not.
It's yeah.
For one thing, you have to get the secretary in place first before a lot of those can be filled. I mean, I remember right. when it took forever for Bush the Elder, because Bush the Elder pushed really hard on the whole John Tower nomination for Secretary of Defense. And so that took 2 to 3 months. It took longer than normal to get a Secretary of Defense nominated because for whatever reason, Bush really pushed hard on John Tower and the Senate basically said, go F yourself. We're not confirming this guy. So William Howard Taft IV was the acting Secretary of Defense, and he couldn't appoint anybody because he was not in a position to do that. So three whole levels of the Department of Defense were left unfilled because they didn't have a cabinet secretary not confirmed. So you get that sort of thing with every new administration. If there is if there are departments that, for whatever reason, take time to get their nominees confirmed, you're going to see a lot of those secondary and tertiary level appointments not made because the fellow's got to get the fellow at the top or the person at the top has to get confirmed first before those other appointments start going through.
But is it also possible that this is some kind of a management choice that, you know, since he's going to make up foreign policy, I'll say by the seat of his pants, he's not really making it up by the seat of his pants, but with less formality than previous presidents, maybe he doesn't need all of those sub-assistant secretaries of this, that, and the other. Maybe he thinks he's streamlining the process.
Yeah, that's the thing. He thinks he doesn't need them.
Right.
But it was one of the things
that type.
Yeah, not just that, but I read this.
Yeah, someone needs to know how to use the fax machine.
Yeah, very funny. Very funny. But Jay Winnick actually had a good book called On the Brink, where he looked at four secondary and tertiary level officials in the Reagan administration. I think it was Richard Perle, Gene Kirkpatrick, Elliot Abrams, and Max Kampelman. And one of the things that that was made abundantly clear for anyone who reads that book is that even a president who knows very much what he wants to do in foreign policy, or any policy for that matter, he needs political appointees who agree with him and believe in him to go through all the bureaucratic warfare with the civil service that may or may not want to necessarily do what he wants and may give him a yes minister scenario. The fact that Trump doesn't recognize that probably means he will end up being more restricted in what he can do, because the civil service will play a whole bunch of yes minister games with him. And he thinks that that's also something that he doesn't need all these political appointees to do his dirty work, when in fact he does need them to do his dirty work. But he
the simple fact that he didn't expect to win and didn't have a deep bench on who he was going to appoint to these positions. He didn't even know.
The thing, though, is that even if he expected to win, there were a lot of people on all sides who weren't going to be keen on working for him regardless. So his pre-election bench was going to be at least somewhat limited by that.
That is also true. A lot of also's here, sorry.
And also.
Also deeply intoxicated right now, just so we're clear.
rumors around town are that people do not want to work for him.
About who?
Just the rumors around town are that, you know, like, I know people who were staffing up at the career level before the hiring freeze, and they were reaching out to Republicans saying, hey, here's your moment, and Republicans were like, no.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That doesn't surprise me.
Working in the White House, that probably looks okay on a job resume.
White
House.
Yeah, that's the thing, is you've got a lot of people who, even if it was a perfectly pleasant job, would be afraid that he turns into a one-termer, and it reflects within the Republican Party about as well as having been a Jimmy Carter appointee.
Jimmy Carter, he's a good man, even with lust in his heart. He's a good man.
Jimmy Carter is a good man, but not a great president.
Do you really think that there are people that would have a chance to be inside a White House administration and would turn it down because, well, gee, if he's only a one-term president, it could adversely affect my career? That is your career, to get into the White House.
The Secretary of Defense turned it down this week.
That was the general
who's going to be National Security Advisor.
Yeah, but one guy did. But, I mean, how many people are going to turn down a sub-cabinet appointment? Because your career, to get into the White House.
What a few. There's a book. Do you guys know the book, What Do I Want to Do With My Life? It's a book that you usually read when you don't have a job. So I've read it several times. But it's short stories about people who had career changes midlife. And one of the stories is about a guy who, like, worked at a Kinko's and quit and ended up working on the first Clinton campaign. And he ended up, like, becoming, like, a regional blah, blah, blah. And Clinton hired him to go work at the White House. He worked there 8 years and became, like, a muckety-muck, right?
That man's name is Al Gore.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, no.
Well, at the end of the 8 years, this guy was just doing right under policy work. I mean, he was doing some real heavy work, right? And he gets out and he goes, gosh, that was a lot of fun. I've worked with network. And so he goes and he does his resume and he starts working around and he goes to lobbyist groups and they're like, so what have you done? He goes, well, I did 8 years in the White House. And before that, I was a manager of a Kinko's. And they're like, oh, yeah, we're not hiring you. and he ended up going back to Kinko's.
Wow.
So it's a fascinating story.
Did it ever occur to him to not say that he was at Kinko's?
His Kinko's, Clinton, Kinko's. And they're like, so have you done anything else besides work? And then he was like, not really. And so now he's the most overrated Kinko's manager ever.
Did anybody here have an unusual career shift mid-career?
I worked politics for like 4 or 5 years. And then I worked casting for 4 or 5. It's the same thing.
I'm actually kind of going through one of those now because I was a cost estimator on DoD contracts for 17 years. And our firm lost the contract where I was working, but the firm chose to keep me. They chose to keep me on board. And I said, you know something, if you're going to keep me around, I'll do, you know, I'll cross train. I'll go through maybe the PMP certification, see if I can get that. I got PMP certification, and now I'm a project manager. And I've stayed with the same firm. I mean, I'm still at LS3 Technologies. They're a fantastic firm. They are incredibly loyal to their employees. I don't want to slur that, no matter how drunk I am. However, what I am doing to earn my keep is now very different from what it has been for the previous 17 years. So even though I'm still with the same firm, I am, in fact, you know, my job description is changing dramatically, and I actually catch myself because I keep saying, they say, well, what do you do? What do you do to earn a living? For years I've said, well, I'm a cost estimator. Well, except I'm not a cost estimator now. Now I'm a project manager, and it has different priorities. It has different tools and techniques and various other things. And
do you have different business cards?
You know, I have for whatever reason, I always tell people I run out of business cards, but the reality is I never actually go ahead and make them.
Neither do I.
That's probably a career mistake on my part. But yeah, it was just something where I am now, you know, I've been in the workforce for 20 odd years, but I haven't been doing what I'm doing for more than 6 months, closer to 4 months actually. And it's kind of weird.
I haven't the faintest idea what I do. No one knows.
But let me ask you this. Before you had kids, what did you do?
I was the project manager on the federal lobbying team for the American Cancer Society. Before that, I was the operations manager for a theater association for theater educators. Before that, I was in grad school. Before that, I was a fundraiser for a arts presenting organization in San Diego County. Before that, I was a fundraiser for a theater in Washington, D.C. Before that, I was a performer for a children's theater in Richmond.
And before that, she was a fetus.
What was that San Diego County part?
I worked for the Performing Arts Center in Escondido.
Okay. My uncle is a high-powered ambulance chaser in San Diego City.
I never had use of his services.
Yeah, obviously not.
Molly, have you always been in academics?
Well, my husband was in law school. I worked in insurance. I was a nationwide insurance office manager. And prior to that, I did some underwriting, and I also did some claims with a company called Indiana Netherlands. And Indiana Insurance got bought out by the Netherlands Group. So I worked for the Dutch for about 9 months. And so.
They're next on the list for an international incident made up by Trump.
Yes. The Dutch. Yes. Yes, that'll we be, should pray for them too.
Actually, the Dutch are having. I think the Dutch are actually having an election.
Yes,
this spring.
Yes, so we're going to make the Netherlands great again.
Geert Wilders is out there essentially insisting that everything is going to hell in a handbasket. So I would not be surprised if Trump confused something Wilders actually said for a terrorist attack in the Netherlands and say at some point, you know what's happening in Antwerp, when even the people in Antwerp don't know what the hell is happening because they have no idea what the hell he's talking about because he thoroughly misinterpreted something Geert Wilders said.
Should we set up like an over-under on number of weeks?
Yes,
that
on
happens,
the Antwerp
or,
incident. That's for in Antwerp.
And you know the sad thing is, well, at least for me, the sad thing is none of you may care about this, but I actually, because I'm such a ridiculous political junkie, I actually followed, to the extent that I could, The Career of Pim Fortune. And
who is
it's
that?
Pretty
what is
clear.
That?
Okay, Pim Fortune was a politician in the Netherlands. He was everything Milo Yiannopoulos wants to be and pretends to be. He was a gay politician in the Netherlands who was genuinely concerned about what Wahhabism was doing to his country, and in particular to homosexuals in his country. Now, he was confused in that he thought Wahhabism was all of Islam, so that what should have been a particular discussion about Saudi-controlled Wahhabism ended up being a discussion about Islam in the Netherlands. But, you know, no human is perfect. But he was, I mean, a left-wing activist actually shot and killed him and murdered him. So he was literally a martyr for this cause. And there are a whole bunch of people who essentially try to take the bloody shirt, if you will, of Pim Fortune and use it to advance their careers. Geert Wilders is one. He's essentially the guy who is the leading anti-Islamic politician in the Netherlands. And again, he's confusing Wahhabism for Islam. And even for this aftercast, I could take forever explaining the differences. But Milo Yiannopoulos, clearly in my mind, Milo Yiannopoulos is the guy who clearly thinks he is the next Pim Fortune. He's not, because Pim Fortune was an intellectual and Pim Fortune was far more intelligent about discussing the politics of the Netherlands and the politics of Europe in general than Milo Yiannopoulos will ever be. But I think in my mind, it's abundantly clear that Milo Yiannopoulos is trying to be the next Pim Fortune. Pim Fortune, for all his flaws, and he was a human, he had a bunch of flaws. I mean, for God's sakes, he thought pederasty should be legalized. But Pim Fortune was a decent guy who saw a threat to homosexuals in the Netherlands and tried to counter it, and was generally sincere about what he wanted to do for the Netherlands. And one of the things that frankly bothers me, and I'm actually tearing up about this, is it's – and I know this sounds funny, but so many people are essentially using him and using his career and using his murder as an attempt to advance their own careers without actually understanding what he was trying to do and the warnings he was trying to give, that it just really, really hurts me personally, because even though I only knew him from various BBC reports and Telegraph reports, I know what he was trying to do. I know the warnings he was trying to give, and that's been lost in the time since his murder. And for whatever reason, that just really hurts.
When was he murdered?
2002. It's been 15 years.
No kidding.
He was murdered He was murdered in the spring of 2002, May 3rd or 4th, I think.
There was a very interesting presentation on Pim Fortuyn at the Philadelphia Society a few years ago. Philly Sock, just by way of explanation, is basically an intellectual group that grew out of the Goldwater campaign. You actually see some very interesting fights over foreign policy within the group.
I can imagine.
But they actually did bring in 3 or 4 years ago. They brought in some European speakers. They brought in the former prime minister of, I forget which of the Baltic states it was, but they brought in, he'd been the youngest head of state for the country in centuries. Well, because their country hadn't existed for a while, but they brought in.
He was 92 years old, but he was the youngest.
Yeah, he was elected prime minister when he was in his 30s, I think it was. They brought him in, and they brought in someone from the Netherlands and so forth. If I recall right, about the only person who was a really lousy fit was a guy from the National Front in France who, bearing in mind that the National Front has a very interesting history, couldn't shut up about some anti-Semitic stuff and was very quickly ostracized within the room. But other than that, there was very interesting discussion about where he was on the spectrum ideologically and so forth, and just discussing how there's almost a, I will say, Hitchensian criticism in there. You know, yes, I know where he meant, you know, the crossing, mixing up Wahhabism and Islam as a whole is, frankly, it's an easy mistake for people to make, because Wahhabism is, and it's ugly offshoots are the most visible versions of Islam in both the literal sense, you know, in that they encourage, you know, coverings and so forth for women, and in the news, i.e., you know, if something is going wrong, it's in that part of the world, it's probably down to either a Wahhabist or an Iranian backed something or other.
Khomeinis is an excellent description for those people, Cliff. That's what awesome. I use.
Can I just jump in and say, listening to DJ and then listening to Cliff, it's finally occurred to me how we can monetize this podcast. Selling Cliff Notes.
I was going to say.
I'm slow clapping that, Cliff.
I was going to say, we should get Webster's Dictionary to.
I mean, am I the only one that sits here and goes, I know I'm getting smarter listening to this, but like reading a Shakespeare play, I really don't know what's going on.
Well, on that note, I am exhausted, and I'm alone with my kids all day tomorrow because my husband's out of town again. So
I actually have school tomorrow. So
wow, what?
I know.
It's President's Day.
Greg, if I may. You do realize that calling it President's Day instead of Washington's birthday, which, of course, I would call it Washington's birthday because deep down I'm a Federalist at heart. But if you actually call it President's Day.
Federalists.
Hey.
But if you actually
President's Day, that means it is a day that honors all presidents, including the current incumbent. Are you sure you really want to honor Donald Trump's day?
Oh, God, we've gone over this before. I hope
it'll be the greatest holiday.
I hope he succeeds. I hope everybody has health care in the end of 4 years. I hope there is no homeless. I hope I get that jetpack that I keep bitching about. Where is my
jetpack? Make America fly again.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
It's been a blast. Oh. Good night, everybody.
All right. Good night. Well,
night all.
Night.